primer lugar deciros que cuando la organización pensó en llamar a este congreso, titular este congreso Prevenir, Castigar, Reintegrar, pensando probablemente en las tres áreas de mayor interés del criminólogo, siempre pensamos tener la posibilidad de abrir este congreso, abrir la primera sesión con uno de los mayores exponentes o académicos dedicados al tema de la prevención, ¿no?, que es el tema que nos ocupa hoy. Y debo decir que tenemos la suerte hoy, para abrir esta sesión, esta primera sesión plenaria, la suerte de contar con el profesor Nick Tilley, de la University College of London, miembro y director del Departamento de Seguridad y Ciencia Criminal, que es, seguramente ya lo sabréis todos, uno de los mayores exponentes ingleses del estudio de la prevención del delito. Tiene numerosísimas publicaciones dedicadas a este tema, quizá destacar tan solo su auténtico tratado manual sobre crime prevention, tan reciente como del año 2009. Entonces, en primer lugar, la verdad que estamos muy honrados y agradecidos al profesor Nick Tilley por haber aceptado nuestra invitación y abrir esta primera sesión plenaria del Congreso, precisamente dedicado a un tema tan relevante como es la prevención de la delincuencia. El profesor Tilley hará su conferencia en inglés, pero se apoyará con un PowerPoint, y también quiero deciros que tenéis disponibles, se ha repartido la traducción de su ponencia para poder seguirla mejor. Hará una intervención de unos 45 minutos, una hora, y después ya me ha dicho que os anima que hagáis las preguntas convenientes, y desde aquí también os animamos. Digamos, el sitio impone un poco, ciertamente, pero se trata, como sabéis, en estos congresos de criminología, de fomentar el debate científico, y en ese sentido os animamos a formular aquellas cuestiones que queráis. De acuerdo, entonces, sin más dilación, le daré la palabra para que de inicio esta sesión plenaria.
Welcome, Professor Tilley. It's a great honor for us having you here to open this congress. And when you want.
Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me. And thank you for that introduction, although I have to say I didn't understand any of it. Paul, I might have said, he's some fat Englishman who's come over to bore us silly. What I'm going to do is to go through this lecture pretty much as it's written for you, and then invite you to ask any questions or make any comments that you might have about it. Crime prevention needs, as I say here, to get the grease to the squeak, by which I mean to say it needs to focus on crimes which are most acute. The next step is to work out what to do about them, and then to decide who's best to do it. What I'm going to do is to, what I'm planning to do is to talk about forms of crime concentration. These are the squeaks where we need to get preventive grease. I'll then go on to explain what I mean by competency and responsibility. These are two key terms for this particular talk. And I want to say a little bit about how responsibility is understood in different countries, including Spain. I'll then say what makes for competency in crime prevention and how this competency maps on to forms of crime concentration, to the sorts of squeaks which crime prevention needs to address. I'll then come back to issues of responsibility and show how those who are often held responsible have rather limited competency, and some seldom held responsible have substantial competency. In other words, competency and responsibility only overlap very partially. I'll conclude by indicating how those competent might be persuaded to accept responsibility. I apologize, first of all, for speaking in English, because I don't speak Spanish. I also apologize for using rather few Spanish examples. What I'm trying to do, though, as I talk to you today, is to talk about generic patterns of crime concentration and about generic issues of competency and responsibility, which would apply in any jurisdiction. So let's begin with forms of concentration. There are four major ways in which crime is concentrated. One is by offender, second by target, third by location, and fourth by victim. I'll say a little about each of them. In relation to all of them, roughly speaking, the 80-20 rule or Pareto principle applies. That is to say that incidents or crimes are concentrated on a relatively small proportion of potential cases. If we take offenders first, in the United States, some 5% of the population commit 50 to 60% of all crime. In Britain, by the age of 32, 7% of males with six or more convictions account for 65% of all convictions of males. So crime is consistently concentrated on a relatively small number of offenders. Although I have to say, almost everybody commits crime sometimes. Almost all of you will at some point have committed one crime or another. Nevertheless, despite that, if we look in the aggregate, crime is concentrated on a relatively small number of offenders. In addition, the so-called age crime curve has been found universally. Participation in crime rises sharply in adolescence and then drops back only slightly less sharply as most soon age out of crime. Although the curves in shape are basically similar for males and females, males commit crime at a much higher rate than females. This is one version of the age crime curve. You'll see different versions using different data in different countries. The same pattern is found pretty much universally. If we move on now to crime concentration by target, not all objects are stolen at the same rate. The acronym CRAVED was developed by Ron Clark to capture the attributes of goods which tend to be stolen. It probably doesn't translate into Spanish very well. It refers to goods that are craved, that are concealable, things that you can hide, things that are removable, things that can be taken away, things that are available where there are plenty of them, things that are valuable, things that are enjoyable, and things that are disposable. This mobile phone is one of the most popularly stolen goods there are, and it's probably stolen commonly here, as it's stolen commonly in most other countries as well. The good that is stolen most commonly in all places, or the goods that are stolen most commonly in all countries, in all cases, is cash and jewelry. Cash and jewelry are high value, disposable, they're available, and so on. Some other goods, like for example the mobile phone, are stolen only of course when they become available, and then when there are so many of them that everybody has got one, then they cease to be stolen as well. So goods are not stolen in same numbers. There are concentrations by target. If you look at victimization surveys and see what's stolen, what never gets stolen, for example, is a very heavy washing machine. It doesn't have craved attributes. Hard to carry around, not very valuable, not very enjoyable, and so it doesn't get stolen. If we look at concentration by location, countries vary widely by crime rate. I'm ashamed to say that Britain has a substantially higher crime rate than Spain. Overall, according to the International Crime Victimization Survey, I wouldn't take the police recorded crime data too seriously in either jurisdiction, but if we look at the International Crime Victimization Survey, the rates for 10 common crimes in England and Wales for 2003-04 stood at around 22%, 22 per 100 population. In Spain, the corresponding figure was 8 per 100 population. Comparing capital cities, London had a rate of some 32 per 100, whilst for Madrid, it was only 13 per 100. In relation to assaults and threats, in England and Wales, there were 5.3 per 100 adult population with one or more incident, whereas in Spain, the corresponding figure was only 1.6 per 100. And within major cities, the rates were 8.6 for London and 2.9 for Madrid. As far as we're concerned here in Catalonia, there were 58.8 58 crimes per 100 respondents in England and Wales, but only 30 here in Catalonia. So there's a consistent variation in crime rate between Spain and England, and I'm afraid you have a lower crime rate than we do. The good news for England and Wales is that our crime rate has been dropping rather more quickly than the crime rate in Spain has been dropping. So the difference has diminished, although you still have lower crime rate than we have in Britain. If we look within a country, we find that the crime rate varies by local authority and within local authorities by neighbourhood. This shows that a relatively small proportion of local authorities in Britain is responsible for a relatively high proportion of all crimes, all recorded crimes in Britain. If we look at this, at these data here, these are from a very famous study by Sherman Garton and Berger, and what they show is that 50.3%, just over around half of all calls for service in Minneapolis were to those with 15 or more calls in a 12-month period, and they comprised only 3.3% of cases. So by location, crime is very heavily concentrated. Already victimized that year. So a huge percentage of crime is against repeats. And repeats tend to come quickly. Elevated risks following an incident is highest immediately after it, and then fades quite quickly. Moreover, there's growing evidence that those near to a targeted property are also at increased risk following an incident. In this sense, crime risk is contagious. So near neighbours are also at heightened risk following an incident. So victimisation predicts further victimisation. Again, a ubiquitous pattern across crime types and across countries. The repeat victimisation patterns have been found. Victimisation. In Spain in particular, the International Crime Victimisation Survey finds that the percentage of incidents repeated against the same person or household every year in Spain in 1989, which is the last time for which I could find data, were as follows: 19% of burglaries, 26% of thefts of cars, 31% of thefts from cars, 31% of cases of car vandalism, 50% of assaults and threats, 8% of bicycle thefts, 11% of motorcycle theft, 20% of thefts from a person, 30% of robbery, and 34% of sexual offences were repeat offences against the same victim. So in Spain, as in other countries, the repeat victimisation appear to hold, at least according to Farrell and Bulacus, who report this in a paper. If we look at patterns of concentration, they tend to overlap. High crime areas are partly high crime areas because of the high numbers of hotspots and repeat incidents. The high number of small locations which are repeatedly targeted, and the same number of victims who are repeatedly targeted. There's also growing evidence that repeat incidents are committed by the same offender. In other words, prolific offenders, high-rate offenders, tend also to be responsible for repeat crimes against the same target. So what we have here are overlaps between forms of crime concentration. Repeat victimisation, repeat offending, hotspots and hot products overlap somewhat, and Graham Farrell suggests that if we want to get the grease to the squeak, if we want to concentrate efforts where they're most likely to have most effect, then we do well to look at the points at which these forms of concentration overlap. Let me move on. So that's just a brief overview, which I dare say will have been familiar to most of you, about forms of crime concentration. Let me move on to issues of responsibility and competency. Engstad and Evans and Gloria Laycock have highlighted previously the importance of responsibility and competency in crime control, and what I've got to say builds heavily on their work. Before coming to the substance, I need to explain what we mean by responsibility and competency in this context. Responsibility in relation to crime prevention applies to those we believe should be held to account for controlling crime. Who do we believe should control crime? Who do we think should be held responsible for controlling crime? Competency, on the other hand, refers to the ability to commit crime. Who's able to commit crime? Who has the power? Who has the authority? Who has the leverage? Who can do something to alter the conditions giving rise to these forms of crime concentration? So competency refers to those who can, responsibility for those who are believed should control crime. The two don't necessarily overlap. And what I want to spend the rest of my time talking about is the relationship between responsibility and competency in relation to key forms of crime concentration. This figure is from a study undertaken by ADT in 2006, where around 1,000 adults were interviewed in each of these six countries. One of the questions related to those who are deemed responsible for controlling crime. You can see here that parents were deemed to have major responsibility for controlling antisocial behavior in all countries. The police tended to come second, but not always. Thereafter, schools and teachers were mentioned at a relatively high rate in Spain, but not so high a rate elsewhere. The community tend to come next, but in Spain, a relatively small proportion of the population responded by suggesting that the community had responsibility for crime control. Then comes central and local government, and again in Spain, by comparison with other countries, a relatively high proportion wanted to hold central and local government responsible for controlling crime. And then when it comes to peer groups, Spain is roughly in the middle. The last three categories, which are not shown but are of minuscule importance in this slide, refer to faith groups, voluntary organizations, and those who had no idea. But it just shows who is generally held to be responsible across countries and the differences between countries. And you can see here the distinctive pattern for Spain. What I want to do is to talk about, in the rest of what I've got to say, is to talk about a rather wider range of candidates for responsibility from those that are covered in the ADT report, in the ADT study. So here we've got under the public sector, the police, the wider criminal justice system, courts, probation, prison, central government, local government here separated, and by local government I mean largely social and youth service, planning authorities and housing authorities, schools and health, but the voluntary sector, by which I include here parents, peer groups in the local neighborhood, and the private sector, by which I refer to owners and managers of places, and also manufacturers. So let me move on to competency now. Any organization to be competent in crime prevention needs to be able to activate a crime control mechanism, which operates directly on the proximate causes of crime events, rather than those that might operate on the social fabric, which are often deemed to comprise fundamental causes of crime. Robert Sampson's recent book on Chicago, drawing on a long tradition of research in that city, persuasively argues that crime in general, and violent crime more particularly, is tied in with a range of other social pathologies to do with health, housing, domestic difficulties, and so on. Radical transformation might address the deep underlying causes of these problems and might therefore be desirable. They might also produce a reduction in crime. But for now, this is disregarded in this paper for two main reasons, and I suspect there may be some hard questions about this. First, the rationale for making the kind of change needed to deal with a complex of interrelated problems would not primarily be to reduce crime, but rather to deal with inequality and inequity, the arguments for which would be no less telling were there to be no effect on crime levels. Let me make the point more sharply. If we're concerned with poverty, inequality, and inequity, if our measures did not reduce crime, would we be any less committed to making those changes? If the answer is no, we think those changes should be made because of inequality, inequity, and intolerable social conditions, then we shouldn't confuse the issue by being concerned with crime. Second, any effort to make these sorts of fundamental changes would likely be slow and uncertain. And my concern here is with crime prevention policies that are quicker acting and surer in their effects. I should add, though it's not included in the text of this lecture, that I also think under some circumstances that dealing with crime and the fear of crime is a precondition for dealing with some other local community concerns. In other words, it's not something which is incidental to them, but is important as an end in itself and as a precondition for effecting larger social changes. The main quick-acting, proximal cause-focused crime prevention mechanisms for whose potential effectiveness there is now ample evidence are the following. Increasing the risk or perceived risk to prospective offenders, increasing the effort or perceived effort to prospective offenders, reducing the reward or perceived reward to prospective offenders, decreasing the provocation to those who are open to provocation to commit crime, or activating rules that can dissuade those who are contemplating crime from doing so. The first three of these operate by changing the balance of real or perceived risk, reward, and effort, and hence what will maximize expected utility on the part of the offender. The fourth removes or reduces what may be stimulating criminal behavior. The last comprises a reminder that the criminal act runs counter to law or moral principle and hence inhibits it. We can go into these in more detail if you like at a later date, but for the moment I'm just stating them as well research-based measures that address near causes of crime and have been shown to reduce crime. They're those that are emphasized in situational crime prevention. They also speak to some recent ways in which deterrence has been construed when it's directed at increasing perceived risk, specifically to individuals and groups that are liable to engage in prolific and serious offending. Mark Kleiman and David Kennedy have developed this argument in some detail with some case studies. At a meta level, it's also important to know how those who are competent to prevent crime, in the sense in which I referred to competence earlier, might be persuaded that they should assume some responsibility for doing so. In other words, what will persuade them that they do something where they're competent to do something? Three major mechanisms have been identified in the literature. Actually, there are more than that, but I'm using three main categories of mechanism: carrots, sticks, and sermons that are often referred to. Sticks comprise regulations and threats that coerce compliance. In other words, we make people assume responsibility if they're competent. Carrots comprise rewards that incentivize compliance. In other words, we give people something to persuade them that it's in their interests to accept responsibility. Or we engage in sermons. Sermons are designed to exhort compliance, to exhort people, to encourage people, to persuade people that they should accept some responsibility. Sticks, carrots, and sermons are sometimes referred to as instruments of government, which are used to try and persuade people to alter their behavior. So who's competent to help activate mechanisms that will control, reduce, or prevent crime in its concentrated forms? And what forms of leverage can they be persuaded to exercise their competence? Who's able to do what, and how can they be induced to do it? Let's go into that now. Competency in relation to offenders. This is to offenders on whom crime is concentrated, where there are squeaks in relation to offenders. The police are perhaps the obvious main sources of control over prolific offenders. They can collect information about current offending patterns, both in terms of individuals and criminal groups. This information can then be used to target those deemed repeat offenders and those who are involved in criminal organizations. Intelligence-led policing is focused on just this. Efforts are made to collect information on active offenders, their typical practices, their plans, and their associations. This is then used to devise strategies and tactics that will disrupt, deter, and incapacitate offenders and offender networks. Unfortunately, there's a dearth of systematic evidence on the outcome effectiveness of such intelligence-led processes, although they're highly plausible and widely believed by those operating them to be effective. In addition to targeting known offenders on the basis of intelligence, the police may also be able to persuade those in need of treatment that they should accept it. One example relates to ex-prisoner drug-dependent offenders who may be led to accept drug treatment on pain of otherwise being subject to close police attention in the event that they offend. In other words, they're coerced into accepting treatment for their drug dependency, which is associated with their prolific offending. Here, risk for the relevant individuals is increased in the short term, and in the longer term, the hope is that their level of offending will fall as the needs motivating much of their crime diminish. Again, strong systematic evidence on outcomes is in short supply, although there is some in favour of these forms of treatment. One of the difficulties in focusing on prolific offenders in the short and long term is the churn, is the high churn in high rate offending. In other words, in retrospect, we know that crime is concentrated on a relatively small number of offenders. Prospectively, it's jolly difficult to work out who they'll be. So providing treatment in advance for prolific offenders is quite difficult. At the same time, many age out of crime. You saw the age crime curve. Most of those who are prolific offenders in their adolescence eventually age out of crime regardless of what we do. Sometimes we're encouraged to look at risk factors, but if you look at the best of risk factors, they're plagued by false positives and false negatives. Targeting effort on those who are deemed most likely to be prolific offenders misses most of them and targets many who wouldn't turn out to be prolific offenders anyway. The police may be able to immobilize informal social control by alerting parents or carers to early signs of delinquency and advising them better to keep track of what their children are doing. Parents act in effect as rule reminders and are also able to apply sanctions that reduce rewards for many offending by their offspring. Furthermore, if they keep their children in, that also makes it more difficult for them to offend. Strong outcome evidence is not available for such low-key interventions, which may be able to preempt adolescent offending in prolific adolescent involvement in prolific offending, but at any rate, it's highly plausible. The wider criminal justice system may contribute to prevention through the specific deterrence of prolific offenders and through their incapacitation. Deterrence is a means of reducing expected rewards in relation to risk. Widely advertised efforts by the police to target prolific offenders and by the courts to impose heavy sentences on those caught and convicted has been found to reduce levels of specific crimes by known high offending groups. David Kennedy's work in Boston on those who are involved and gang members who are involved in shooting is a classic example of this targeted deterrence. There's additional evidence from the Netherlands that increasing custodial sentences on drug-dependent prolific offenders who refuse treatment substantially reduces crime in the community. Ben Vollard has written some interesting papers, I think, on that, looking at the provisions in the Netherlands for relatively long offences for this specific subset of the population. And those who are incapacitated simply cannot commit crime in the community whilst they're in prison, although they may, of course, be able to commit crime within prisons, which are themselves characteristically hotspots of crime. Just as the police may be able to identify those in the early stages of what might turn into a criminal career, so too may members of the community whose vigilance increases risk to the youngster and who may also be able to let parents know of emergent delinquency. Their parents may then act in the ways described to stem criminal involvement. If we take competency in relation to, quite a lot of competency in relation to offenders, and offenders have been the typical focus for efforts to reduce crime. But offending is not only concentrated on offenders, it's also, as you said earlier, concentrated on targets, on locations and on victims. And I want to say a little bit about who's competent to act in relation to those. Whilst the police and criminal justice system more generally are best placed to devise and implement preventive strategies targeting prolific offenders, insofar as they can be accurately identified in advance, their competence in relation to hot targets of crime is much more limited. The police can do little more than keep track of emergent hot products and then try to persuade those who are competent to do something that they should assume responsibility for doing so. The main group that's competent to reduce the vulnerability of hot products comprise the manufacturers of them. These are clearly members of the private sector. Hot products are precisely those that are wanted by consumers. The demand for them creates the market for stolen goods. Some thieves, unable or unwilling to pay for the relevant products, will also take them for their own consumption. It's the manufacturers who are best placed to devise and incorporate security features into those products that'll make them more risky to steal, more difficult to steal, or less rewarding to steal. Far-sighted manufacturers may also be alert to the theft risks provided by the products they're making and hence build security in from the start. Governments are competent to put pressure on manufacturers to take some responsibility for the security of their products. They may do this through a mix of sticks, carrots, and sermons. The classic example of the processes involved in persuading manufacturers to accept responsibility for the security of their products, their improvement in security, and the resulting reduction in theft relates to motor vehicles. In the UK in particular, a car theft index was produced and published by the research arm of the Home Office in 1992. This publication identified makes and models that were stolen at relatively high levels as a means of shaming their manufacturers into reducing the level of their vulnerability to theft. It appears to have been a rather successful sermon. In Australia, the countries of the European Community and countries of the European Community, a stick's also been used. The incorporation of electronic immobilizers of a minimum standard is now required by law in all new cars. The results of the security improvements to cars are now clear. They resulted in very substantial falls in the numbers of thefts. In Britain in particular, where we've looked at this in some detail, theft of them from cars comprised a quarter of all recorded crimes in the early 1990s. They've now dropped from some 600,000 a year to less than 100,000 a year, and they now comprise a much smaller fraction of all the crime that's been committed. There's strong evidence that it's the security improvements that generated that drop in car crime, which is out of proportion to the drops in other forms of crime, and that improvement in security levels was a function of pressure that was applied by government to manufacturers. Pressure applied by the accumulation of evidence that was able to identify those types of cars, those makes and models of cars that were most stolen. We now move now to competency in relation to location. Remember, locations are another form of crime concentration. The police can keep and analyse strong data on the locations of reported crimes. Powerful and low-cost GIS systems enable sophisticated analysis of hotspots of crime. It's much easier now to analyse the ways in which crime is concentrated geographically. And of course, that's a prerequisite to applying measures targeting these areas of concentration. There's substantial evidence that police problem-solving directed at crime hotspots can produce strategies that reduce the level of crime there without its displacement to nearby locations. Braga and Weisbird's recent book of 2010 goes into this in some detail. The strategies might include targeted patrol at the places and times when crime levels are highest. It may also include efforts to remove or reform crime attractors, those facilities that are drawing those wanting to commit crime to the location. It may include efforts to persuade those in high crime locations to put in place measures to increase risk, for example, CCTV, or increase effort, for example, better locks, or reduce rewards, for example, rapid removal of graffiti, or reduce provocation, for example, the provision of more efficient services, or remind those liable to offend that they should not do so, for example, with signage. Here, the police can apply those levers, for example, advice, threats of withdrawal of services, that may be at their disposal to persuade the locally competent to accept responsibility for improving security. But the police are poorly placed directly to apply those measures that are these sorts of measures that are liable to reduce the crime concentration in specific locations. They can, of course, have directed patrol, but in other ways, they're rather poorly placed to act directly. Those most competent to deliver crime prevention at high crime locations will often be those who own or manage facilities there, members of the private sector. John Eck and his daughter Emily have recently advocated a regulatory framework for making place owners responsible for the crime produced there, on the grounds that its cost is borne by third parties, including the general public. The assignment of responsibility is, of course, a matter for local and central government. It's a form of leverage to compel the acceptance of responsibility for controlling crime that's being produced. Whilst for bars and car parks this makes sense, because the victims are private sector third parties and are clearly beneficiaries from the activities attracted to the high crime location, is less clearly appropriate where the high volume crime is a side effect of poverty or racial tensions in a local neighbourhood, which is sometimes the case. In these hotspots, others may be more competent and may be more reasonably held responsible for controlling the conditions generating the crime in those sorts of high crime locations. Local government and local partnerships may be competent to put in place various measures that increase the risk or perceived risk to those who might otherwise offend. Improvements in lighting and the introduction of closed circuit television, for example, in high crime locations can lessen levels of crime there. Members of the local neighbourhood may be able to impose informal social control over those who are liable to offend in high crime neighbourhoods. For example, they'd be mobilised to challenge the excuses used by offenders to rationalise their criminal behaviour, a technique that's been used in so-called call-ins, again by David Kennedy, for street gang members in the United States. Many of you will be familiar with Robert Sampson's works on collective efficacy, which has to do with the activities of members of the local neighbourhood in controlling crime there. What is much less clear from all Robert Sampson's work, including his recent book, is how you generate improvements in levels of collective efficacy when it's missing. If we turn now to victims, the final form of concentration I want to refer to here. Those who are victimised are often best placed to reduce their risks of further crime. There is, however, a danger of victim blaming if efforts are made to encourage them to assume some responsibility for taking measures that will lessen the chances that they'll suffer further crime. The most frequently mentioned case where this criticism is made is that of a woman who wears short skirts and is thereby deemed to be at risk of sexual assault. Few, if any, would argue that she should in any way be blamed for any crime committed against her. But does this mean that no victims should ever be encouraged to assume responsibility for the crimes they suffer? I think not. Consider the case of a shop that repeatedly suffers from shoplifting. Here, the way the shop is run affects the risk of shop theft. The costs of the crimes committed from shop theft are largely borne by the community, not only in the form of the price set for goods to offset the losses incurred, but also in terms of policing and processing offenders who are caught, as well as any more indirect costs that might include drawing some into an easy way of life funded by crime. Many might think it reasonable that the merchant be held responsible for taking reasonable precautions to reduce the risk of thefts against his or her retail establishment. The classic case in the literature refers to the sale of records in Oxford Street in London, where one shop displayed them in their sleeves and tried to control the frequent shop theft that ensued by stopping the offenders as they left the shop and calling the police to deal with them. This one shop was responsible for 40% of arrests for shop theft in the Oxford Street area, one shop, by virtue of the way in which they sold their records. The costs to the police were enormous, and the simple expedient of redesigning the shop and keeping the records most often stolen behind the counter whilst displaying only their sleeves could and did preempt the theft problem by making it much more difficult for thieves. It seems to me reasonable in this case that the victim be held responsible for reducing the risks to them. In other forms of repeat victimisation, the police can provide advice and mobilise community support for victims in ways that are aimed at increasing risk and effort to the offender and also reducing reward. The Kirkcult Burglary Prevention Project is probably the best known initiative that adopted this kind of approach. Cash prepayment meters, which proved attractive to thieves, were removed, reducing the rewards for burglary. Cocoon neighbourhood watch schemes were formed of close neighbours around victims to increase risks to offenders in the period after a burglary when risks of re-victimisation were highest. Target hardening security improvements were made to victimized properties to make further crime more difficult. The result was a very substantial and sustained reduction in overall burglary rates and a virtual elimination of repeat burglaries. In Kirkcaldy, over a four-year period where burglary rates were not dropping nationally, the victimization rate went down from 25% to 6% by this focus on repeats. There's some evidence that the poorest households, which suffer the highest rate of burglary, are least provided with but most effectively protected by good household security. This is in some unpublished work that will appear on a book on the international crime drop later in the year. The fact that the poorest households have their risks most effectively reduced by security improvements suggests that local or central government might sensibly subsidise security improvement for the poorest members of the community once they're victimised. This would comprise a carrot for either private landlords or local authority landlords. Likewise, tenants are often at high risk and their landlords might be held legally liable to provide minimum security. This would involve the use of a stick. For those who can afford to improve their own security, the police can advise on the measures that could be taken to reduce the chances of further incidents, as well as letting them know that they're increased risk. That would involve a form of sermon. So stick sermons and carrots can be used in relation to those who are at increased risk of repeat victimisation in order to improve the security there to reduce the chances of subsequent victimisation. It doesn't turn out that fear of crime is increased in this way, but that's another matter we can go into. One of the strongest arguments in favour of partnership is, one of the most strongest arguments in favour of partnership in crime prevention relates to the overlaps in crime concentration, where those competent to deal with different forms of it can work together to implement joint strategies. Here, the competences of each member of the partnership can complement one another in ways informed by an analysis that explores empirically the precise contours of the given problem and the opportunities to intervene that it presents in relation to offenders, targets, locations, and victims. What this chart summarizes is, I'm not sure it's done particularly well, but I think it's a useful exercise. What it tries to do is to map competencies in relation to forms of crime concentration. So it looks at what the police might do in relation to crime concentration in regard to offenders, locations, victims and targets, focusing on the crime prevention mechanisms that I articulated earlier. So who can do what in what circumstances to reduce levels of crime concentration? What's interesting about it, I think, is the fact that those who are competent are not altogether those who are held responsible in ways that were shown in the AGT survey that we looked at earlier, for Spain in particular, but across jurisdictions more generally. In other words, what parents can do is rather limited. They can't do anything about crime concentration by location, victim, or target. They can't do much in relation to offenders if we take the proximal causes. So those held most responsible have rather limited competence in relation to crime prevention mechanisms. The police can do quite a lot, but often it's leverage rather than direct action. They can provide leverage and information in relation to victims and targets, but they can't do much directly to deal with concentration of crime on victims or concentration of crime on targets. And in relation to high crime locations, they can slightly increase the risk by targeted patrol, but otherwise what they can mostly do is to provide leverage and information on third parties who can act in relation to crime concentrated in those locations. They can do quite a lot in relation to offenders, but they can't do much about the effort and reward equation which leads to high rate offending by individuals. Contrary-wise, what we see is that private sector can do quite a lot, and the private sector wasn't even mentioned in the ADT survey. They're seldom thought of as those who have some kind of responsibility in relation to crime prevention, yet from what I've said earlier, they have quite wide competency in relation to crime prevention. In other words, competency and responsibility don't overlap as much as they might, and what central government can do, what local and central government can do, is useful largely in terms of the sort of leverage it can apply on those who are directly able to alter conditions which lead to these forms of crime concentration. So, what I have to say is a little bit more about this. It'll be clear, to summarise, whilst there's significant mismatch between responsibility and competency, progress in crime prevention will be held back. In other words, if we're going to make progress in crime prevention, competency and responsibility need to correspond much more closely, I think, than they do at the moment. Many who are competent may be reluctant to accept responsibility because of the costs incurred. In some cases, it may be that those who are competent should not be held responsible because it would be unfair to do so. Moreover, governments have a long-standing responsibility to provide for the security of their citizenry. Indeed, providing for this was one of the main rationales for government in the first place. Nevertheless, to discharge that overarching responsibility successfully may require that governments make sure that those who are competent directly to control crime, where it is concentrated, play their part. This requires recognition of the limits of what the state and its agencies can achieve directly, which I've suggested is quite heavily circumscribed. It'll be clear that in asking about competency and responsibility of crime prevention in the community, I've said rather little about the community. Community is notorious, is a notoriously slippery term. And I've avoided spending a lot of time talking about what it means. It's used to refer to a whole host of things, to those who live in a small, defined residential setting, for example, a street, those with common interests, for example, businesses, those who inhabit the same neighborhood, for example, Oakland, Chicago, those who identify themselves as the same ethnic, as members of the same ethnic, religious, or occupational group, for example, Muslims, residents in a city, for example, those who live in Girona, national groups, for example, the Spanish or Catalonians, and even international groups, for example, the European Community. The notion of responsibility implies some obligation to another. At the very least, communities are made up of those who have some form of mutual concern. What I've tried to do is to spell out here how and where this might best be expressed in the service of crime prevention, taking community to be in a rather inclusive sense, to refer not just to the citizenry, but to the agencies of state and the private sector and the voluntary sector also. With that, I think I'll finish. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Chili. Tenemos tiempo para cuestiones, comentarios. Siempre cuesta la primera pregunta, pero os animamos a que si alguna cuestión de la ponencia queréis que el profesor la explique un poco más o alguna duda. Gracias al profesor René.
Thank you for your presentation. Actually, I have a combined question. First is that you speak about crime prevention in general terms, though your examples are mostly related to property crimes, minor property crimes. To what extent does your thesis also apply to violent crime or major fraud cases? That's the first thing. And secondly, to what extent has the overall crime drop in the UK been attributed to major investments in crime prevention?
Okay, thank you very much. Do you want to translate the question for the others?
La primera pregunta es básicamente lo que le ha preguntado el profesor René, es que es la teoría del profesor Till y los ejemplos que ha puesto son, si os habéis fijado mayoritariamente, de crímenes contra la propiedad. Todos temas ejemplos de crímenes contra la propiedad y le pregunta si esta teoría se puede aplicar a otro tipo de delitos, delincuencia violenta, básicamente. Y la segunda cuestión, le preguntaba si el descenso del delito en Inglaterra se debía a las las inversiones que se han hecho en prevención del delito.
Okay. That gave me time to think about the answer. Firstly, in relation to violent crime, I do think the arguments apply. Crime is often concentrated on particular bars, particular drinking establishments, and in city centres, when people have been drinking heavily. The sorts of measures that I've talked about might be relevant in particular to crime, violent crime in bars, in the sense that the management practices, whether or not people are sold drink when they've had too much to drink already, whether or not people are provided with seating while they drink, whether people are served food at the same time as they drink, these circumstances in bars are significant in relation to the amount of violence that's produced there, and so mobilizing bars, incentivizing bars to accept responsibility for the violent crime associated with them is one of the ways in which you can persuade them to apply these sorts of situational measures, I think, that reduce crime. John and Emily Eck, in a recent paper in Criminology and Public Policy, talk about bars in particular as locations, high crime locations, where they suggest you could introduce regulations requiring them to assume some responsibility for the rate of violent crime taking place there, and that there are management policies and practices that could be put in place to reduce it. I mean, the other obvious example as far as violent crime is concerned relates to in the United States, they have a lot of homicides, which seem to be largely a function of the availability of guns there. Gun control laws are an important way of restricting the facilities available for people to kill one another. I rather fancifully wondered about trying to persuade cutlery manufacturers largely to make knives with blunt ends rather than pointy ends, which make it more difficult to stab. So I think some of these sorts of measures can be thought about in relation to violent crime. In relation to on fraud, it's more difficult. I think that Mike Levy has talked a little bit about the ways in which we can alter the ways in which businesses are operated in ways which make fraud more difficult. We can try and make money laundering more difficult by incentivizing banks to provide us with information, by making banks which can be used to disguise stolen assets less conveniently available for those who want to commit fraud. So I think some of the sorts of measures I've talked about can be applied to fraud and violence, although I didn't mention them at the time. In relation to the overall crime drop in the UK, there's been rather little research on it, and I suppose I've been involved in the rather little research that's been done. So I'm prejudiced in relation to the conclusions we came to, which are that security improvements in relation to vehicle crime in particular were crucial to the drop in crime. There's a lot that we don't know about the crime drop in the UK. Surprisingly, we don't know about the UK. We don't know whether it's a function of people starting there in relation to offenders. We looked at situational measures. We speculate that making car crime more difficult has had knock-on effects for other sorts of crimes as well, because cars are used to commit other crimes, and car theft is also a debut crime. And if you inhibit the debut crime, maybe you inhibit the start of crime careers that have a wider span. I think there are things we don't know. We don't know whether people are starting their crime careers later. We don't know whether they're finishing them earlier. We don't know if those who are involved in crime are committing a smaller number of crimes. We don't know if the crime drop is largely a function of fewer people committing any crime at all. We know very little about how the crime drop is constituted in terms of criminal behavior, which is a bit shocking, really. So many criminologists with so much to do and doing so little in relation to what seemed to me to be crucial issues. I'd love some of you to take an interest in that as well. I really would. Anybody who wants to talk about the crime drop, please come and see me. I'd be delighted to talk about what might be possible.
¿Más preguntas? ¿Por allí? Las preguntas se pueden hacer en castellano y yo intentaré hacer la mejor traducción posible.
Okay. I prefer to do it in English. When you were mentioning about race and crime, that if we consider about race as an aspect on communities, speaking that some spots might have a higher crime rate depending on the race, I was thinking, how to what extent do you think it's like vice versa problem? I mean, there is the extended thinking that some races are more willing to commit crimes, so therefore they don't have many opportunities, and as a consequence, it's like a vicious circle. So to what extent do you think that having a more inclusive policy about race into business or that can contribute to this reduction on crimes depending on the race?
Okay. I think that, can I answer that in two ways? One is that improvements in welfare, improvements in social conditions, social improvement doesn't necessarily lead to a reduction in crime. In the UK, social conditions improved enormously after the Second World War in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. And the crime rate went up enormously. So I don't think anybody, me in particular, would want to say we should not have had those social improvements in spite of the fact that they were associated with increases in crime. They were associated with increases in crime largely because people got better off and there were more things to steal. So there are good reasons to have some social changes, even though a side effect is to produce more crime. So I want to reduce crime, but I don't want to inhibit developments, improvements in wealth, improvements in well-being that might have as a side effect increases in levels of crime. It seems a perverse thing to say, but I think we might have to pay one of the penalties we have to pay for increased wealth, for increased female participation in the labour market, for more mixed neighbourhoods is an increase in crime. If you ask me then, do I think that if we created a more inclusive society we'd have fewer people who were alienated, fewer people who felt distanced from the community, I think that's probably right. But I think even if we didn't have crime prevention as a consequence of those changes would still be desirable. In other words, I would be no less keen on improving community integration if it didn't produce any crime reduction side effects. I think it's not a particularly good reason for trying to control crime. The other point I'd make is that in some neighbourhoods, the reduction of crime may be necessary in order to reduce some community tensions. In other words, the level of intimidation that exists in some high crime neighborhoods inhibits the development of social integration, and the reduction of that level of intimidation may sometimes be achieved by the sorts of measures I've talked about and some relatively strong police intervention. But it can be done very badly. I mean, it's a complicated issue. In Britain, in Brixton in 1981, riots were precipitated by heavy-handed policing, by policing that was insensitive to the community conditions that operated there. And if policing is undertaken in ways which is not perceived to be legitimate by members of the community, then that is liable to reduce the cooperation with the police and may heighten community tensions. It's a complicated issue.
I have a question about the argument that you've been making about the relationship between social policy and crime prevention.
Yeah.
I think that you have presented good arguments about it, and you could also develop similar arguments from a more critical perspective. I mean, you know, the idea of criminalization of social policy or governance through crime are examples that, I mean, our arguments are saying, you know, we shouldn't have too cozy a relationship between progressive social policy and crime prevention.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, we can't simply ignore these issues, can we? I mean, one of the distinctive features of British society is that it's one of the most unequal societies in Europe. Yeah. And when we look at the International Crime Survey, we also see that, you know, it's one of the countries with the highest victimization rate. So, I mean, I wonder how you reconcile these things with the arguments that you're trying to put forward.
Well, it's a challenging question. Thank you. A difficult question. I think the criminalization of social policy, as it's sometimes referred to, is problematic. I also think that there may be changes in the social fabric which are significant as far as crime levels are concerned. And I, of course, welcome any changes in the social sets of social arrangements which bring a crime prevention dividend, although not if they're at the expense of other kinds of social utilities. So, the issue is to that extent partly political. I could imagine a society where there were very high levels of surveillance, very high levels of state involvement, very high levels of, which would be relatively low crime as a result of that level of surveillance. I wouldn't want it. So some social policy changes I don't think I'd welcome. And one of the reasons why I like these sorts of proximal causes is that I think they produce, not none, but I think they do produce some political difficulties, some issues of trade-offs, some issues of aesthetics. But I think the problems are relatively small compared to the problems that follow from some other sorts of social policy. And if we talk about inclusiveness, I suppose I do think that the crime prevention side effect of inclusiveness is not a particularly strong argument in favor of inclusiveness in relation to other kinds of arguments in favor of inclusiveness, which I think are much, much more powerful. So I find myself in sympathy with, I think, what would be your policy aspirations, but less in sympathy with using those using crime prevention as a basis for arguing for them. Although I'd welcome crime prevention if crime prevention were a byproduct of those policies, I'd be delighted. Is that a... Thank you.
Thank you. Continue a little bit in the same line as Juanjo, but in a very concrete way. How do you perceive ASPOs, antisocial behavior orders in this respect, as crime prevention or as criminalization of social policy?
Well, yeah. I have done one piece of empirical research about the introduction of ASBOs in Nottingham, and they had no effect at all on the levels of antisocial behaviour. I think we've done one of the few empirical studies that looked at the use of ASBOs in relation to antisocial behaviour, and they simply didn't have any effect whatsoever. So I'm not much impressed by the empirical evidence of the efficacy of antisocial behaviours as a way of reducing antisocial behaviour. Nevertheless, would I dispose of antisocial behaviours altogether, or the version that the new government has suggested, which is a kind of rebranding? I'm not sure. I think that I'd dispense with them, because there may be conditions in which they're quite useful. But as a general method of reducing antisocial behaviour, some people would object to them because they try and criminalise people. They take behaviour which is... People are given ASBOs for non-criminal behaviour. If they don't accord with them, then they get a criminal record. That's a way of drawing them into the criminal justice system, whereas they wouldn't otherwise join it. And I think they're undesirable for those sorts of reasons. They're ineffective as a method of controlling crime. So to that extent, they're for crime prevention purposes, they're just not a very effective tool. Would I get rid of them entirely? Probably, I'm on record as saying probably not. But used in a much more selective way. There's little doubt that in some the reason I say I wouldn't get rid of them entirely is that there are some high crime neighbourhoods where a relatively small number of youths basically terrorise local residents, and I just think some forms of statutory control over them is a good idea. It's easy for me, who lives in a nice neighbourhood, to say don't have ASBOs because of the effects they might have on criminalisation. If I were living in a really depressed area with feral children, young children who are out of control, causing a good deal of upset for everybody living in the neighbourhood, I think I would welcome the police having some leverage over those young people to control their behaviour. It would be at the upper end of one of the interesting schemes that I looked at was one where the child first came to the attention of the police would go and visit the parent, then they stepped up interventions, and only in desperation did they apply for an ASBO. And I think those, having a reserve power, having that power ultimately available to the police, it may be sensible. Sorry. Any other? Go on, some of the students. The students got some questions. Or any of you saying, well, this just doesn't apply in Spain or in Catalonia, I don't know.
Sorry, I'm not a student. Well, if, as you correctly point, no victim should be blamed if not competent, and you refer explicitly to sexual crime victims, yeah. Why, for instance, burglary victims should be, as it's somewhat suggested? For instance, to conceal the goods is a effective preventive measure, but it is also a free marketing technique. So to what extent is it fair to blame them for showing the goods? And as for repeat victims, is it possibly, in my opinion, more unfair to blame them because you yourself have theorized it, each time they are victimized, they are more powerless, I mean, less able to afford preventive measures. Thank you.
It's a good question, thank you. I think in relation to burglary victims, one thing that used to happen to burglary victims is that they were told that lightning doesn't strike in the same place twice. In other words, if they've experienced a burglary, they're unlikely to experience another one, so don't worry. I think that was bad advice empirically, because we know now that they're at increased risk if they've been burgled, and I think that it's useful for people who are empowered if they know more about what's likely to happen to them. I think as far as the very poor are concerned, and if people are living in rented accommodation rather than in their own homes, then one, the motive, and two, the capacity to improve security is rather limited. And to that extent, I think it's useful to improve their security. If you take, I mean, this work hasn't been published yet, but if you take the poorest members of the population in Britain, if you go from no security to improvement security, they're 20 times less likely to be victimized. Not 20% more less likely, 20 times less likely. The mismatch in risk, if you increase these security, is absolutely enormous. And I think that public policy improving the security of people who are at high risk of being victimized is quite sensible. I think the other thing about the other thing about victim blaming is, I don't think you can answer the question universally. If you take victims of domestic violence who are archetypal repeat victims, some of the most successful work has involved police action and mobilization of neighborhoods in relation to women who've been repeatedly victimized. The project in a part of Leeds called Killingback was very effective in increasing the intensity of intervention in relation to repeat calls about domestic violence. I don't think anybody would want to blame victims of domestic violence for being victims of domestic violence. So in relation to them, one, informing them, but two, trying to build protection and at increasing degrees of intensity in relation to repeat incidents seemed to me to be a sensible policy.
Hi, thank you very much for your speech. My question was that we find some questions, some journalists keep asking us, criminologists, if now with the economic crisis, crime rates will increase and soar up. And somehow, as you said, in United Kingdom, there's a crime drop. And I think also in Spain, crime is not increasing. And somehow this is counterintuitive. And I would like to hear your reflections. How come is crime not increasing so much with this economic crisis? Thank you.
That's a great point. I think it's a function of poor popular criminology and some poor criminology by criminologists who have assumed that improvements in social conditions will reduce crime and deterioration in social conditions will increase crime. Neither of which is shown to be the case. I recall listening to a comedy program on the radio where somebody was making fun of somebody's pronouncement that crime would go up as a result of the economic crisis. It's obvious it'll go up as a result of the economic crisis. Well, it's not, and I think it mistakes the drivers of crime. I went and gave a lecture in Edinburgh a few weeks ago where my fellow presenter was arguing that the economic crisis comprised a potential source of explosive crime rates that were around the corner. He might be right. But we've waited for some time now. We've had economic difficulties for some time, which have not, as it happens, been associated with the expected explosion in crime. The work that we've done has suggested that improvements in security have reduced crime levels. I don't think for a moment that's the whole story. I think there may be other things going on as well. The hypothesis which I've not managed to test, but which I'd be delighted if somebody else wanted to test, is that improvements in consumer credit have been associated with reductions in property crime because people have managed, without money, to get new goods without having to steal them, or without having to get them from the stolen goods market. And if you track increases in consumer credit and crime levels, you find that where increases in consumer credit has increased enormously, we've got a drop in crime rate. So there's a kind of correlation. I wonder if there's causation going on there as well, which would be a mechanism entirely different from the one that relates to improvements in security. I don't think we know enough about what's produced the crime drop yet. I don't think we know enough empirically about how it's expressed. There's a lot of uncertainty there, and there are for any budding young criminologists, I look to those in blue around here, for any budding criminologists, there are some fascinating issues to try and unpack with potential helpful policy consequences. But I think the equation has just been has reflected the immaturity of some of our thinking.
¿Aún tenemos tiempo para alguna pregunta más?
There's a hand up there.
No. No sé si señalaba.
doing that? Questions?
Si nadie se anima, pues lo dejaríamos aquí en este momento. Muchas gracias a todos por venir.
Thank you very much to Professor Chili for such a brilliant conference.